You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Tour de France, in association with RAFA, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004. Today we are in Bergerac.
Where are we, Lionel?
Well, we're in the outskirts of Bergerac, outside our press room, next to one of the Boutique Officielle vans, which sells Tour de France t-shirts and hats and that kind of thing, playing a bit of music behind
us. Europop drifting across, helping us keep our energy levels high.
Woo!
But after a rest day, our energy levels, we are recharged, restored, replenished, ready to go. Good evening, Francois.
Good evening, Richard.
That's Francois Thomazeau. Let's reintroduce ourselves because we're a week into tour now. Some of you might have just started tuning in the last couple of days. And Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard Moore.
Thank you.
And Francois Thomazeau recharged last night with the biodynamic, as they say, Bergerac wine.
We did. We did have a glass of that. And we should mention at this stage, before we forget, this morning, our latest episode of Kilometre Zero was Francois on Food. And that was basically recorded a meal with Francois, a very, very French meal in a beautiful little hotel near Nuit-Saint-Georges, which already seems like a long time ago, where we ate very well and had some nice wine. And Francois talks us through that and much else besides. We discuss whether snails are farmed or free range.
We run around.
We covered a lot of stuff.
There were even a few Tour de France references in that episode. Just a couple.
Not many. I think they were edited out, actually, Lionel.
Well, you have Romain Bardet talking to you about wine. You know, that's something.
Bardet on wine, absolutely. Okay, so as you can probably guess, today wasn't perhaps the most crucial stage of this year's Tour de France, but it happened. And can you give us the tale of the attack, please, Lionel?
I can, Richard. The race restarted in Périgueux. We've moved all the way over to the Dordogne. Stage 10 went to Bergerac, 178 kilometres. There was one non-starter this morning, the Polish rider with Bora Hansgrohe. Rafał Majka was a non-starter after his crash on Sunday. It was pretty gentle stuff out on the road, so Johan Afredo of Wanty Group Gobert attacked right at the start, and a few kilometres later he was joined by Elie Gesbert of Fortuneo Ascaro, and they rode out in front on their own all day. They had a gap of 5:30 at its maximum, 5:30, and they were caught with 7 kilometres to go, and we had the expected sprint finish. Lotto Soudal did an awful lot of work for André Greipel in the finale, but Greipel could finish only 12th. But it was a good day for German riders because Marcel Kittel won his fourth stage of the race, matching the tally he achieved in 2013 and 2014. Another German, John Degenkolb, was second, and Rüdiger Sellig of Bora was fourth, making it 3 Germans in the top four. Dylan Groenewegen of the Netherlands, the Lotto NL Jumbo rider, was third. No change to the jerseys, and we may get more of the same tomorrow. We're back in a sprinting groove, and Marcel Kittel is head and shoulders above everybody else. He came from so far back today, it was probably the most impressive of his 4 wins so far.
Well, actually, just before we get onto that, I spoke to Jack Bauer, the New Zealand rider, on Quickstep this morning. Here's what he said. And a win for Marcel Kittel.
Another win for Marcel Kittel, number four. Let's bring it on.
Jack Bauer there calling it. He was confident Kittel would get stage win number four, and there it was. Francois, sorry.
Yeah, no, well, I really don't really know what to say about Marcel Kittel. I mean, he won the, he won the four sprints. Well, actually, in different fashion. There is a quick step train, but he doesn't use it the way he used to in 2013 and 2014. He uses it to be well positioned for the last stretch. But that, he doesn't need a lead out man these days. Even if in this case Sabatini was a guy who set up actually his last stretch. But what they do apparently is really try to after recons to place Kittel in the best position in the last, let's say, 600 meters, and then it's up to him, and he's so strong that he doesn't need a lead out man, he does it himself. And to be honest, in the four sprints we saw, well, the one was pretty close, as we saw against Edvald Boasson-Hagen the other day, but apart from that, today, as you said, Lionel, it was way above the rest. The rest, they obviously did him a lot of good and didn't harm a little bit the others, because we were expecting Greipel, who usually is better in the second week, like Christoph, to have maybe taken some advantage of the rest day to try and go up a gear, and it was not the case at all.
Greipel faded badly, 12th. He is a fading force, I think.
At last, our prediction comes through a couple of years ago. Yeah.
I was waiting at the Lotto Soudal bus for Teish Banut, who was up the road a couple of days ago on Sunday. Impressed to see him ride in that way on Sunday. He was away for a while with Warren Barguil. And then today be a part of the train for Lotto Soudal and did a very good job. The team did a very good job, but it was a very conventional sort of lead-out train. And clearly Greipel didn't have the legs in the end. I am not suggesting that the others play dirty, but it seems to me that the only way to beat Kittel would be for him to be boxed in. And for, instead of those riders sitting in front of their sprinter, but to actually get in the way of Kittel. That's not really the done
thing. Advocating some kind of shenanigans in the finale?
It's not unheard of, is it?
No, it isn't. But today he was all the way over on the right-hand side of the road at one point, quite a long way back, and he moved himself left. Yeah, Kittel came across the road and then went around the outside, not as far around the outside as he did the other day, and I think it was Troyes, but it was another, real head and shoulders above the rest type of performance. And, the other sprinters must now be asking themselves what they can do to try and get on terms, because the way it's going, Kittel is going to end this tour with, if not, 5, 6, possibly even 7 stage wins. And I mean, he's already got 4. That's a tally that he's achieved a couple of times in recent years. Cavendish won 4 last year. Andre Greipel won 4 in 2015. You have to go back to 2011 for the last time a rider won 5 sprint stages of the tour. That was Cavendish. And Cavendish, of course, won 6 in 2009. Kittel's in that league, isn't he? Mm-hmm. He's, the competition is actually quite deep when you look at the fact we've lost Sagan, we've lost Cavendish, we've lost Demar, but then there's still Degenkolb, Groenewegen and Christoph Buhani, McClay even.
Yeah, McClay was actually not good. I mean, he tried. At least, we've been talking about Dan McClay for a long time, and he never quite delivered because he has no train, let's face it. And today, at least, I mean, he attempted something. He attacked from early on, was not strong enough, but I mean, maybe that's a way to at least try something. Because otherwise, if these guys don't try anything, I really can't see how they're going to beat Kittel. As you say, the green jersey is already almost on Kittel's shoulders. As we said at the very beginning of the Tour de France, with this course, with fewer mountains and more sprint stages, maybe even a rider like Peter Sagan would have struggled to keep the green jersey against Kittel, because there are so many sprints, and it helps Kittel. Obviously, is the strong favorite now to win. And another very strange oddity: we complain at the beginning of the tour of these hard fought sprints with lots of actions, crashes, and everything. We were hoping for more regular sprints. Now we have regular sprints and regular, and I should say, consistent Kittel victories.
Well, shall we hear a little bit from Davide Bradamati, one of the sports directors at Kittel's Quick Steps Floors team?
This season, what makes Marcel so strong? It's amazing. Every sprint, he looks stronger.
Yes, it's true. Also today, he did a very, very stronger final, and he did a special sprint. He won with one bicycle, and we are very happy. First stage for him is very nice.
And it's always a different sprint. I mean, sometimes he has the train, sometimes he doesn't have the train, sometimes he's from the back, sometimes from the front. He seems unbeatable.
Yeah, today was easy. Yesterday was a rest day for everybody. All the bunch recover a little bit because start second part of the tour. But yesterday we did a recon, and we taking a video. The riders this morning, they saw. And we said it was important to enter in the good position in the last corner, and Sabatini put Kittel in good position, and then he did perfect sprint. He's very, very strong in this moment, and it's not easy for the other fighting with him.
Can you imagine the other sprinters? I mean, they must be demoralized at the moment. I mean, they try everything and it doesn't work.
Yeah, maybe. This is the cycling in this moment is very, very strong, but the hotel riders need to think always positive because never know what can happen in the sprint. For moment, Marcel is the best because he won a four sprinter, and we will see tomorrow maybe will be again possibility. We will see if we can win again.
Is the green jersey in the bag now, would you think?
Yeah, we saw now Matthew is a little bit so far in the place of the stage, and we will see step by step. Was important to try to win, and he won, and we are very happy.
Well, Kittel is better than all the rest, but you know, it was a good day for the Germans. John Degenkolb never really looked like holding on against Kittel, but he's sprinting quite well and can have a little bit of confidence and maybe even think about perhaps going in a breakaway on one of the more kind of rolling stages that we've got coming up. Dylan Groenewegen was swamped by the Dutch press at the Lotto NL Jumbo bus this evening. He has basically said that, you know, he doesn't want to be risking his neck for sort of third or fifth or sixth place, which he was third today. He's had a few other top tens here. But it's very difficult to see how they can beat Marcel Kittel when he's in this form. I suppose the man of the day, in a sort of surprise sense, was Rüdiger Selig, the rider with Bora Hansgrohe. He came here as a support rider for Peter Sagan and would have been part of a lead-out or preparation group for Sagan in the sprint finishes, but he now has his own chance. And I grabbed a few words with him at the finish. I was under the impression he was a lot younger than he actually is, but he's in fact 28. I was probably fooled by the fact this is only his third Grand Tour. He rode his first Grand Tour last year for Bora, that was the Vuelta, and he started the Giro this year and did the first couple of weeks, and this is his first Tour de France. But he's you know, he's fresh in the sense that he's got relatively few miles on the clock, even though he's ridden for a number of years with Katusha. But I asked him, well, I started off by asking him whether he was happy with his performance.
Technical final, and the peloton was really nervous because the stage was not super hard, so it was really tricky to fight for the position without a helper for me was difficult, but I think I made it really good with positioning. And yeah, I was at the end fourth, but the last corner I crashed almost and I lost a bit of speed. But then with the slipstream, I came further and further to the first position, and then I just gave all. So it was not easy.
You're getting some really good results here. What are you learning as the Tour de France goes on?
Yeah, of course, for me, it was I came here to do my lead-out for Peter. So you have to change your mind from lead-out to sprint. It's a big difference because as a lead-out rider, you have to be careful about your last man, always stay a bit in the wind. So, yeah, I think day by day, a bit better. And, yeah, we'll see what's happened.
Marcel Kittel came from a long way back. I mean, that was a real jaw-dropping performance. I mean, what can people do to try and beat him? When he comes from so far back, it looks almost impossible.
Yeah, so true words. I think he's another level. He's the fastest sprinter in this Tour, and we just can hope that he make a mistake. Otherwise, no chance.
And try again tomorrow?
Yeah, of course. Every day we do the best and try to do the victory or win a victory. But yeah, with Kittel and Greipel will be difficult, but we try our best.
Hi, I'm Kristen. I'm a ride leader in the Rafa Clubhouse in Amsterdam, and you are listening to the cycling podcast in association with Rafa.
The Rafa Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kit and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you very much to our main sponsor, Rafa. We are very grateful to them. And a reminder that throughout July, they are celebrating the art of climbing with Rafa Rising. Among the initiatives connected to Rafa Rising is a competition that they're running along with us, the Cycling Podcast. Cycling Podcast listeners are being offered by Rafa the chance to win £1,500 worth of cycling kit. Simply visit rafa.cc/TCP win and answer the question that you will find there. The competition closes on the 23rd of July, with the winner announced the following week in the podcast. Let me know if this bit is okay. yeah, that's fine. We will announce the winner the following week in the podcast. So listen, we were going to talk a little bit about the breakaway, because every day on a stage like this, there is a breakaway. It invariably features a wanted group Gobert rider, and a plug here for a Kilometre Zero we did called Breakaway Kings last week on wanted group Gobert and their breakaway kings, among whom is Juan Ofredo, who was in that first road stage break with Taylor Finney, and he was up the road again today. And Francois, you spoke to him at the finish. He had some very interesting things to say.
Yeah, he was... Well, am I going to use another, kind of... actually, he does in his interview use a four-letter word, but...
We'll bleep that out, I think.
He was... I must say he was pissed off. There's there's not any other expression. He used frustrated, but it was more than that. Because he said, look, every day... guys from Wanty Group Gobert and guys from the French team, that's Fortunio, and today was Elie Gesbert. There's a little story about Elie Gesbert this morning, and maybe that's the reason why he broke away to make amends. You know that during the rest day, Elie Gesbert was in his room. He put a towel on what he thought to be, I don't know, a chair or something. He was actually an electric radiator. And when he left, he thought he was switching off the light of the room. He actually switched on the radiator, and the result was that there was a fire, and the hotel had to be evacuated, and the fire, the fire squad came, and I mean it was quite an eventful day for the French team, Fortunio, at their hotel yesterday, and all because of this young guy Elie Gesbert. But anyway, back to Ofredo. He was saying, we're trying every day, we're going in front. Now we reached the middle part of the Tour de France. Many teams have no other objectives than a stage win, and there's only two of us in the break. He said it's absolutely crazy. Other teams could have been in this break. Other teams could have tried to stop Marcel Kittel win his fourth stage win. He said, had I was on the road, it was nice, the crowd was there. Had I been on my TV watching this, I would have been bored to death, he said. And even so, he didn't say so to me afterwards when I saw him at his car. But on French TV, he said, I call on all the riders who want to join the breakaway tomorrow to join me at the Wanty bus at 9 tomorrow morning. So, it was like a call to arms, because...
I'm thinking I might get my kit on and turn up with my bike, maybe.
Get your Penlar de Charme jersey on.
Well, shall we hear from Ofredo, and then we'll discuss a little bit more.
So, Johan, another long break today and a little bit of frustration at the finish.
Yeah, because it's always for nothing. And we are only two to try to take the breakaway, and I don't understand why. Why only two team? One Fortunio, one Wanty. Okay, we are small team, and we need to go in front to have some publicity for our team. But I don't understand why there is a lot of team who help Quickstep, and because it's always the same guys who win the stage. It's always Marcel Kittel is the best sprinter actually. So I don't understand why there is not a lot of riders that want to go in the breakaway to take some publicity or to try to win the stage.
Maybe not many riders have the same temperament as Juan Ofredo.
No, or maybe I'm wrong, because maybe it's my first Tour de France and I'm naive, and I'm a little bit too much enthusiastic, or I don't know, but there is something wrong. I don't know if it's me or but I think there is a real problem. Maybe there is not enough motivation for the guys. Maybe I don't know.
You're talking of maybe awarding points to SKPs. It would be an idea.
Yeah. Why not? Why not? Because I think it's boring for everybody, for spectator, when you are behind your TV and
you watch a stage like today? You're okay, it's good for sleep.
But it was not boring for you, was it?
No, because it's always amazing to be in front, and there is a lot of public, a lot of... it's like a dream for me, but I'm a little bit sad after a race like today, so...
So that was Johan Alfredo. I must apologise for my pronunciation of pedaleur, Deschamps, just before we heard that interview. But some interesting ideas from Johan Alfredo there. He's got, he was on French television afterwards. He has got fantastic hair as well, I was reminded.
He's always had fantastic hair, yeah. He's kind of a, you know, well, he's quite a good-looking guy. I mean, I like the way he looks on the bike. As you saw in the interview, he's a nice and very... clever and cute in many in all the senses of the word. I think he's an ideal candidate for Pedaleur.
Well, he was up there for Pedaleur Deschamps last week, and he'll be up again this week.
I'm going to follow up on some of his ideas, because I don't want to get into criticising the Tour de France. I mean, it's a fantastic event. Stages like this are as old as time. You know, there have been stages like this in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and so on. Well, hang on a minute, Richard.
There's a but coming.
But as sporting entertainment, there was not an awful lot to recommend that. If you had sat and watched it all day, the countryside of the Dordogne is fantastic, but there, you know, maybe when they passed Lascaux, they should have gone in, taken the camera crew into the caves and showed the prehistoric cave paintings
for an hour and give a guided tour
of that. Or perhaps, you know, stop the camera motorbike could have stopped at La Roque-Gageac for the prettiest village in France for a coffee, or up at Dom for an ice cream. You know, maybe the cultural Tour de France would, maybe it needs something a bit like that, just to bring the thing to life on a day like today.
Absolutely, but I tell you what, in the old days, even before I was born, there were bonuses, there were awards, there were prizes on the road. Like, every village, more or less, gave a bonus for, you know, or the guys would win their weight in ducks or something, or their weight in wine. But every little village had its banner and was offering something to the riders. And it was an incentive to send them up the road, if only for 400 meters. And these days, as you say, in one sense, it's become much too...
formulaic.
Exactly, formulaic. And in the same time, I think that maybe from time to time we didn't realize that in the past, because we didn't have an all-day coverage of the race, and that many races throughout the season, you only see the last hour, and you say, oh, well, that's exciting, because of course, you know, they know... In the 70s and 80s on the Tour de France, the race actually started when the TV was on, you know, because the riders knew, the TV will be on at 3:30, so it's about time to start. But these days, it's finished.
The problem is that if you came up with some really innovative ideas, perhaps you could offer, points for every kilometre that riders away, or the net result would be that Quickstep would close things down more quickly for Kittel. Offered, say, I don't know, I was thinking the other day, maybe if you get a maximum time gap of 5 minutes 50, you get that time, the 5:50 chiselled off your GC time. I mean, that's a wacky, radical, off-the-top-of-my-head idea, but all of these things, if they implemented them, all that would happen is that the bunch would chase harder, and you might get anarchic days, but you might also get a really controlled race.
A day like today, when you have two men up the road, you know they've got no chance. You know that the bunch can very easily bring them back. With 8, 9, 10, it can make things a little bit more interesting. But when you go through every team on the start sheet, you realise all of them either have a sprinter or a GC rider or both. And so they're really, Wanty Group Gobert are one of the only teams that are up for getting into breaks. I don't understand Direct Energy, really. They seem to have a leader.
Well, they were actually trying to prepare a setup of sprint for Thomas Boudat. Well, I have nothing against Thomas Boudat. He was world champion on the track. He's a great
11.
He's a great talent. But I mean, he's young. He's never done Grand Tour sprints. There was not the hint of a chance that he might. So yeah, they might tell you Direct Energy. Yes, but he has to learn. So we needed to put him in position of being in a Grand Tour sprint. Blah blah blah. But the I remember when I started in this trade. I've done it too a long time and everything. But even in the 80s and sometimes in the 90s, a guy on his own could go all the way from the start to the finish and win a stage. It doesn't happen anymore.
Well, here's another absolutely amazing idea. I'm going to copyright this one. What they should do is at the 30-kilometer mark have a little deviation. The break goes the short way to the finish. The bunch has to go a slightly longer way to the finish. And then they come back in onto the main course. First people to the finish line win. That would be outstanding, wouldn't it?
I think
you could see, listeners, the look on Richard's face. Exactly. He doesn't like that at all.
And I'm sure the local authorities in around cities and regions wouldn't. But I think
stop being so practical. It's a great idea.
But I think the simple idea that they put forward by Alfredo, saying just award points, UCI points to escapees, that then maybe teams who really need points to get up in hierarchy would really send guys in the front.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you to Science in Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. A reminder that you can get 20% off all your Science in Sport products at scienceinsport.com. Enter the code TCP20. That's TCP20 at scienceinsport.com. Now, in this part, we're going to hear a little bit from some of the sports directors and former riders, what they made of the thing that we talked about a bit on Sunday, which was the situation when Chris Froome had a mechanical problem, Fabio Aru attacked, and the riders waited. So we're going to get a few little views on that. But first, I bumped into our old friend in the press room. Daniel, an interloper in the press rooms, television's Daniel Freeb. Hello, Daniel.
I know, I walked in through a cloud of nostalgia. I miss this place. I miss the press room. Not here very often anymore.
No, you're not. Well, you've got important work to do at the buses. And on the rest day yesterday, you went to see Chris Froome and Team Sky. Chris Froome shed any more light on what happened the previous day?
No, he's fairly adamant it wasn't a shoulder barge. And I don't know. What do you think? What did you say on the podcast? I mean, usually I would have listened to the podcast, but I didn't yesterday. Didn't get time.
I think we're quite divided on this. I mean, it could easily have been an accidental wobble. You know, if you've just made a big effort to get back to the group, that can happen on these hairpin bends. You know, it can happen. It's an amazing coincidence that Fabio Aru was next to him just as it happened.
Yeah, it really was an amazing coincidence. But the other point is, does it really matter?
Doesn't really matter. I mean, people compare it to Peter Sagan, and I don't think Peter Sagan's move was intentional, by the way. But you know, he wasn't. Whatever happened, and there was contact, whether it was intentional or not. George Bennett thought it was intentional. You know, he was sitting behind it. He thought it was deliberate, and his view was, "Good on you, Froome." That's a quote, by the way. That's not me speaking. You know, he wasn't going to do major damage to Fabio Aru if that was the case. We don't condone it if that was the case. He can't admit that it was the case, but it might have been.
Yeah, and just on the issue of whether Aru was entitled to attack or not, whether he saw Froome or not. I mean, Froome, he wasn't quite sure, I don't think, and he's not quite sure whether Aru had seen him. But, you know, is it legitimate to attack a yellow jersey or anyone when they're having a mechanical problem? I think we've said this before. The bike mechanics, are part of the race. As far as I'm concerned, they're as much a part of the race as a crash or anything else that people refer to as a racing incident. I mean, I spoke to Rolf Aldag, the Dimension Data Direct Sportive, this morning about this, and he said, "Well, what? I think it was an issue with his electronic gearing, wasn't it? Froome's electronic gearing. You know, what if they hadn't charged the battery adequately? And you know, Richie, if I was a professional cyclist, my record with mobile phone batteries, that would probably be happening to me about three times a stage. But you know,
you'd leave the charger in every hotel.
I would. And if that was the case, then you know, Froome should be punished for it, shouldn't he? Should be punished for it on the road. But you know, we've said this before about punctures and there are ways to make your bike less likely to have mechanical problems, and you know, there's a trade-off maybe in speed or in, you know, something else. But I think racing is racing. Once the flag goes down in the morning, pretty much anything goes.
Well, I mean, Lionel made the point yesterday, Daniel, that never has an 18-second lead looked so kind of convincing and solid and commanding, really, because that's the lead that Froome has over Bardet. Is that still a long way to go? But he does kind of look unbeatable, does he not?
I don't necessarily think so, but the most persuasive argument to suggest that he is incredibly comfortable is his body language and Sky's body language and the kind of confidence that they've been exuding, not just in this tour, but I would say since the Dauphiné. It was quite striking at the Dauphiné how assured they seem to be, in spite of the fact that they were actually losing to Richie Porte. And I asked for him yesterday whether at any point this spring and in their head-to-head battles he'd been genuinely worried that Porte was just out of reach, that Porte's form was just too good and he'd raised the bar. And Froome said yes, actually. I mean, it's easy for him to say now because Porte's no longer a threat, he's out of the race. But certainly since the end of the Dauphiné, they've seemed unbelievably confident. And Froome himself, I don't know whether it's just the experience of having won three tours already, but he does carry himself with an awful lot of kind of assurance and poise, and never really seems flustered. And the way he rode that descent into Chambéry, the Mont du Chat descent, really was symptomatic of or exemplified that, and contrasts with Porte, I think. Unfortunately, I did sense that Richie Porte was getting a little bit more nervous towards the end of the Dauphiné, and sure enough, he lost the jersey on the last day, and I did feel that he was getting a little bit edgier towards the end of last week. And you know, it was perhaps just bad luck, the crash, but you know, Froome, these things don't seem to befall Froome too much.
And a word, I think, for the vanity signing has been his outstanding domestique, the most consistent, very riding a very un-vanity signing like way. I mean, he's Mikhail Kwiatkowski, we are of course talking about, once famously described by Daniel as a vanity signing. He's been turning himself inside out for Froome.
Yeah, not bad for €17 million a year or whatever he earns. No. Yeah, he's riding extremely well. And again, I think the way Kwiatkowski's riding, there's an obvious contrast with BMC. And we saw Nicholas Roach in the break on Saturday. And, you know, there was some tactical justification for that, but I would suspect that when Nicholas Roach signed for BMC at the start of the year, he was promised a certain degree of freedom, even in the Tour de France, maybe a day or two when he was allowed to go for a stage win. And that would just never happen at Sky, would it? Even Kwiatkowski, a former world champion, as long as they're going for the yellow jersey with Froome, he's not going to get any freedom whatsoever, and I don't think really expects it.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, similarly with Greg Van Avermaet on the Seiche de Longwy, he was given latitude that day, a day that would have suited Kwiatkowski as well. I gather you interviewed Taylor Finney as well, Daniel. How did that go?
It was mind-bending. It was a truly, I would say, even disconcerting experience. I don't really know Taylor Finney. It's the first time I'd ever spoken to him at any length. And yeah, I won't forget it in a hurry.
So Daniel and I covered a fair bit of ground there. We did talk about that, the issue of the etiquette. And as I mentioned earlier, this morning in the Start Village, we spoke to a few people about that.
Let's hear first from Team Sunweb's boss, Arne Visbeek. Arne Visbeek has got a vested interest in this subject because his rider, Tom Dumoulin, was attacked, in inverted commas, by Vincenzo Nibali and Nairo Quintana during the Giro d'Italia in May, when Dumoulin had to make a rather uncomfortable and unscheduled visit to the toilet on the roadside.
Yeah, no, like I said, I think the best way to respond to it is wait on that moment and see if you can get Froome back in the group quick. And if that happens, I think you have a fair race up the Mont du Chat. And I think that is where everybody wins, the spectators and also you have not a tainted victory or a tainted success. But of course, I also you cannot wait forever. So that situation suits all itself quickly. I mean, if the team cars are not there and it's a long wait, then you can only wait for a little bit.
And Francois also spoke to the general manager at Francis Dujeux, Marc Madiot.
Moi, je considère qu'à partir du moment quand la course n'est pas lancée, que
I consider that as long as the race has not actually begun or in a transition stage without any impact on the outcome of the tour, it's not a problem whether riders wait or not. But once the hostilities are underway, in the heat of action, when the little known rider crashes in a break, nobody waits for him. I understand we're talking about a yellow jersey, but I don't like it when it's too polished, too well-groomed. We're in a race, in a competition. We're not here to make bows or kotos. Respect, yes, but we shouldn't overdo it. Yeah, it's up to Haru, but if, like he said, he had not seen it, I don't see why he stopped. If he didn't see Froome at a problem, he didn't see it. That's all. He should have done his thing to the finish.
I'm Dagoto Lauritsen, ex-pro bike rider from Norway. I raced 2 years with Peugeot and most of my career with 7-Eleven Motorola. You know, now I'm not really a rider anymore, but inside myself I'm a rider. I was professional for 11 years, and I think it's cycling is a rough sport. It's a tough sport. It's bloody hard, but I think it's good to have some gentleman's agreement. It shows that the people here, sometimes they change teams and they are enemies on the bike, but they're still friends. And to have some rules like, please don't attack in the feed zone, have respect for the yellow jersey, I think that's good. And you saw that example the other day when Haru attacked and Froome had problems. Haru say he didn't know, but I don't know. I think you should respect the jersey and then have a fair fight for winning without having problems. I remember when Contador attacked also when Sleck had problems. And he won the Tour de France with that little difference that he made that day. And later they took away the jersey. But for me, have respect for each other. It doesn't only count the yellow jersey, but the riders among each other.
I think it was very strange, very strange. I think he got support enough from his teammate. I can't see no reason waiting for Froome. As far as I know, nobody waited for Dan Martin when he crashed on the downhill. So I heard about that room before. It started like a bit last year, 2 months 2, when the crashed Sky was pity, and Froome like sort of waved his arm like they should wait. That's a silly new rule I never heard about. As far as I know, you say Tour de France wait for nobody. We do our races. We doesn't ride to make anybody lose, you know. As far as I remember, already to Lies, he was involved in the crash to Lies, the little climb. And actually, I spoke to our riders after, because Froome, he was quite close to win the stage. I said, you took a little bit too easy. And they said, yeah, but Froome, he was down. We waited for Froome. I said, we don't care who's winning, you know, but we do our race and they do their race. And just keep in mind, nobody was waiting for Dan Martin. Everybody was riding with Dan Crash. So again, I think it's a silly thing. You feel like attacking, you're attacking, whatever happening.
Do you, I was thinking back, did you ride the 87 Tour?
Oh, yes.
You remember
in Berlin?
That was your, that year Jean-Francois Bernard was in the yellow jersey.
Yes,
and he punctured. Yeah, he punctured and then he was attacked in the feed zone. That's the sort of thing that used to happen. Do you remember that specific stage?
Not really, to be honest. But in the past, you would do stuff like that, attacking the feed zone. It still happened on and off, like especially when we're around Marseille, you know, like we went a few times. But, you know, when you do like that, you better make sure you make it to the finish line, otherwise you're going to die also. But that yellow jersey thing waiting, that's probably a new thing Brailford fought up, marginal gains or some silly stuff like that, you know. Like.
So some interesting views there, Lionel. I think we didn't speak to any riders about this, but my sense certainly was that most of the riders were very much of the opinion that the Richie Porte, Romain Bardet and co. did the right thing in encouraging Fabio Haru not to persist with his attack and to wait, basically, to calm down and wait for Chris Froome. We're not going to go over and over this again, but...
No, there's a very good reason why the riders, you know, they're quite happy to have a situation where they don't take advantage of one another's mechanical problems, because, you know, what goes around comes around. And, you know, one day you could be on the receiving end of, you know, some bad luck and have that really hammered home against you. And so you can understand why the riders would have this kind of, you know, code of honour, I guess. I mean, I don't want to use the word omerta about it, but certainly it's interesting that riders who have now retired and are sports directors, you know, Brian Holm well, the only person that really said anything very, and Maddio saying, you know, that the race is the race, and really they should, you know, all just get on with it.
It's funny because the older generation think it's, you know, there's nothing wrong about attacking the yellow jersey when it's a mechanical, and the new generation or the active riders seem to say the opposite. The problem is active riders are happy on a day like this, like today, because, you know, leisurely stroll around the castles and caves of Périgord and Dordogne is fair enough, but it's boring for the spectators. And in the same time, you know, mountain stages, you know, the yellow jersey as a mechanical, we don't attack it. And the result is Kittel wins this one, and Chris Froome is a happy, you know,
I mean,
man. And the result is with all this, sort of, that's like what Maddio says, you know, I don't want the Tour de France being too well groomed, and in many ways that this is a story of, you know, hard guys, les forçats de la route, and these days, well, we have the impression you've got civil servants going to work, you know.
I mean, one thing, you know, people talk about the tradition of respecting the yellow jersey. I think I made this point the other night, that really, you know, respecting the yellow jersey is fine when it's early in the stage, when it, you know, a rider might have to stop for a pee or whatever. The tradition isn't that old. I mean, I think that the tradition of stopping and waiting at a critical point in the race maybe happened the first time in 2003 when Lance Armstrong fell off. Was that Sage to Lose Arder then?
Yeah, he caught his handlebars on Charles Musette.
And Tyler Hamilton, you know, urged the others, a bit like Richie Porte the other day, he urged the others to calm down. A similar situation. Tyler Hamilton was a former teammate of Lance Armstrong. Brian Holm, when we stopped recording this morning, said in stronger terms how much he felt it was like Francois's favourite word. And he said that the first time he could really remember it happening was 2010 on the stage to Spa, when there was a crash involving Andy Schleck and his teammate Fabian Cancellara, a.k.a. Chief Commissar, actually went and got the race officially neutralised with ASO. And that was really unprecedented and set a bad precedent. Yeah.
2010 was the key moment. I think that's really, you mentioned 2003, which was the start of it. 2010 was a key moment when Fabian Cancellara decided, because he was the boss of the peloton, that we're not going any further because my teammate crashed. And in the same edition, Contador did the same when he stopped the peloton because Samuel Sanchez had crashed.
And yet it was the same one, the same tour where we had the chain gate affair where attacked.
So Andy, I guess, Schleck. 2010, which is very, you know, recent, was a moment when these new traditions came into force. And maybe you're right, and that's the impression I had, and we discussed it last night, and I said the same. You know, the tradition to me was launched by Lance Armstrong because it you know, it favored his dominance, and any tradition, you know, created by Lance Armstrong to me is a little bit dubious.
Well, we could go round and round in circles on this one, couldn't we? And the people who think that Fabio Aru was out of order to attack won't have their minds changed, and the people who think that Chris Froome, the other riders shouldn't have made life easy for Chris Froome, they won't have their minds changed either. But we're going to look at this issue from a slightly different point of view, aren't we, Richard and Francois? Because a forthcoming Kilometre Zero will examine a stage from 30 years ago when the yellow jersey was not only attacked in the feed zone and after a puncture. I mean, it really was a triple whammy on poor old Jean-Francois Bernard, and we'll tell that story in a forthcoming episode.
Yeah,
it will
be a look at the good old days.
Yeah, and one of the guys involved in this attack, Charlie Mottet, this
and
morning.
And Mark Maddio.
Yeah, Mark Maddio was there. Charlie Mottet this morning had strong words off the mic. This was a nice one, yeah. Nice slip of the tongue. off the mic. He told me, he said, you know, I can't understand why Fabio Aru attacking Chris Froome, which is not illegal. You know, that's the rules of the race make it perfectly reasonable, is criticized, whereas a few, you know, the further down the road, Chris Froome, you know, had a maneuver that was, you know, dodgy to say the least, and he got away with it. So in Mottet's mind, if somebody on that stage should have been punished, it was Chris Froome.
Well, we touched on that, Daniel and I. We really don't know whether that was accidental or not, and we don't want to whip up anything. But Fabio Aru was a bit daft to launch such a spectacular attack at that precise moment. You know, not not very clever, perhaps.
Well, unless, as you said earlier, Rich, when we were talking about it, unless, you know, his whole strategy for the
stage.
Yeah,
but it looked like he was attacking because of Froome's mechanical.
Well, it did. And probably he was. I mean, one sports director told me this morning that it was the chronology of it was pretty clear. The call came out on the radio, and there was plenty of time, you know, for that information to be digested that Chris Froome had a mechanical problem before Aru attacked. So that, you know, I'm struggling to give Aru the benefit of the doubt, but then on the same side, I'm struggling to give Chris Froome the benefit of the doubt on the maneuver, and I'm struggling to give the other riders the benefit of the doubt.
We're just struggling. Let's examine this again in this forthcoming Kilometre Zero,
and let's not mention it again. It's
over. And so is tonight's podcast. Lionel, you got something to say?
No, sorry.
You stuck your hand up like Chris Froome. You got a problem with your rear mech. Yeah. Anyway.
Oh, Francois elbowing me now. This is getting out of control.
That's all for tonight. Lionel, thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Francois. Thank you, Richard.